The electric chair was designed for use on a grown man. But because he was a boy of 14 years old and small for his age, George Stinney Jr. didn't quite fit. It was rumored that he had to sit on a stack of books, one of which was a Bible, to reach the apparatus that would cause his ultimate death. His head was smaller than the typical adult, and so after the first attempt, the headgear slipped off and the execution had to be temporarily halted while it was reattached. Nevertheless, on June 16, 1944, George Stinney Jr. was put to death by the state of South Carolina for a double murder he did not commit.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. Usually, when I help to tell a story of a person who has been exonerated, they are almost always the voice you hear most throughout the episode. But in this case, that's not possible. George Stinney Jr. was executed on June 16th, 1944, at the age of 14. I need to take a second to talk about a sponsor that's pretty much saved my life. Sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day. With babysitting and working and podcasting, and I'm sure you feel the same. So if you're still making time-consuming trips to the post office, you also need a better way. Use stamps.com. With stamps.com, you can get the postage you need the instant you need it. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. It's quick and it's easy. You'll save money with stamps.com too. It's just a fraction of a cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Plus, you'll get special postage discounts you can't even find at the post office. I've had a pile of items in my closet that have just been waiting to be sold on eBay, but I just didn't have the time to take them all to the post office to be shipped. Now, with stamps.com, I can save money and time printing postage right from my desk and make money finally ridding my closet of those old treasures. Right now, you can sign up for stamps.com and use my promo code ACTUAL for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and an adorable digital scale. Get started with stamps.com today. Within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Before you do anything else, go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in ACTUAL. That's stamps.com. Enter ACTUAL. I was lucky to have made contact with Mr. George Frierson.
I was born in Alcaloosa, South Carolina. This is where the incident happened in Alcaloosa.
Who is the foremost expert on the story of Mr. Stinney.
So anyone who was born in Alcaloosa had heard the story. So this is nothing that is novel. The only thing that is that I'm a military veteran also, and I have children. And to think that something like this could happen to a child, well, I don't know how you would take it from me speaking in a spiritual aspect, but I'm a chaplain. And to think that a child was done this way by a society, and he was not a child. He was only 14 years old. And, you know, it's, well, as I say, back in 2004, I read about the 60th anniversary of his death, and that's what was the catalyst for me looking into it as a historian. Not as an activist, not as a lawyer, but as a historian. And there were some things that happened in that case when I looked at it and saw the evidence that I could surmise was very troubling. And so we got underway, got motivated, and got started on every place I could go to find anything about the story that I knew was factual. We went wherever it led. And it was a 10-year journey. We are so grateful that the Creator actually saw fit to allow me to be the one to uncover something that was not true. In fact, I mentioned in my Sunday school class several occasions, and we talk about predestination and being called by God to do something that's not necessarily just to preach. And so we stayed in that realm of thinking and realized that He looked down the lines of time, because He can look forward and backwards at the same time. And He saw a little guy that was going to be born in Alkaloo, who was going to love history and is going to know the law, and also one that believes in true justice. I guess you already know that I'm Black. That's how I got started, and it just expanded from there on out. And I am grateful that there are some people that can actually see, it can start out one way, but it can end up another, especially if the way it started out was not true. And I tell young men especially, I say, now, you know if you did something or didn't do something, because I speak at prisons. God knows, and you know. Others may not know the true story, but God knows and you know. And if He see that you're being honestly treated, regardless of the time, because one day, as is 1,000 years to Him, and you know, it's a long life, well, more, you live on a lifetime for us, but in His eyesight, a day is just a second. And so, the truth will come out. Well, we just got started and then almost got addicted and obsessed with it. In fact, I had one of my sons tell me, he said, we want our daddy back because I was so immersed in this case. Because I thought about it, I said, this could have been me. Oh, this could have been one of my sons. So I made it personal. And really, it really got personal.
When Mr. Frierson talks about George Stinney Jr., he refers to him as Mr. Stinney out of respect. At first, it was ironic to me that Mr. Stinney is now receiving that respect, because I imagine, as a young Black boy in 1944, he was probably never referred to as Mr. Stinney. I asked Mr. Frierson if he could give us some information on Mr. Stinney's background.
According to family accounts, he loved drawing things. He could draw an airplane while it was passing by, so the world could have been denied one of the great artists of all time. And the other thing is, I look at another great man in the Black race, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., on January 15, 1929, exactly 9 months and 6 days before Mr. Stinney was born. That's the gestation period for a pregnancy, right? So I'm Dr. King, was, actually born. Mr. Stinney was in the process of being conceived by his parents. Yeah, think of what if the state of Georgia had done for Dr. King, what the state of South Carolina allowed to be done to Mr. Stinney. The world would definitely be a different place, and I'm sure not as good a place. And so I look at almost anything from the mirror of history. Black men were being disenfranchised for whatever reason, fear, jealousy, or whatever. And a lot of there was Black flights back in the 19-teens and the 1920s, where Blacks saw that there was no opportunity for them because of the color of their skin. So they started leaving the South, going up North. I'm pretty sure you heard of the Northern migration. And so his father, who had a job opportunity to work with the lumber company in Akaloo accepted it, because actually Mr. Stenny, and I always call George Jr. Mr. Stenny, okay? I don't call him George. And, you know, he actually moved his sign because of employment opportunities. And I'm pretty sure if he could look back and saw that that would have led to the death of one of his children, that wouldn't have been even been the consideration in what he was about to do. So I just look at that. Maybe this was supposed to happen because we even learn from bad things that happen. At least we should. And so this was a bad incident that happened, and black males during my time as a youngster and a teenager were told, you know, be careful how you intermingle with white females because of what happened to that child. Now, I wasn't born at the time Mr. Stenny was living. And so I cannot give any firsthand accounts of anything, only research.
I wanted to know more about the crime that Mr. Stenny had been accused of.
The exact indictment said, in fact, it was multiple indictments, that he killed an 11-year-old, Betty June Benneker, and also that he killed a 7-year, 10-day-old Mary Emma Timms. You know, there's published account that she was 8 years old. But her birthday, she turned 7 on March 14th, and this happened on March 24th, so she was only 7 years and 10 days old. You know, there was a person in the community that the black community knew that was a pedophile. And, you know, he was always lurking around, and apparently he had desires for young females. And, well, it's always been said he was the culprit. In fact, the family even said that there was a deathbed confession given to them by this individual. However, I cannot verify that outside of the family's account, so I never pursued it from that case because he was never arrested, tried, and or convicted for the crime, so I never called his name either. But what the family did say did motivate me to go and look into his history, and everything they said about him was true.
Two young girls were killed, and even though there was a known pedophile in the black community, he was not the person investigated in this crime.
This happened a Friday afternoon when the girls went missing. The call went out that the girls were missing. He related to someone that his younger sister, Amy Lou, really, I had seen the girls that afternoon as they were inquiring about some places of Maypops or flowers. Some say Maypops, some say flowers, but whichever case, the young girl, it would have been in season. And so when the girls asked that they know where they could find what they were seeking, they told them they did not know. So the girls went on. And the unusual thing is the girls was in what we call the black side of town. They were different sides of the railroad tracks and different strokes for different folks. But let me back up. The Benekers and Timms actually live on the side of the railroad where the black home sections were, but they were not in the black community per se. And so when it went out that he had seen them, in fact, they came, according to the sister, who was 7 at the time, and got her brother George and Johnny. Johnny was older than George. And so they took them down the road, and she said it was 8 white men. And so she was so afraid, she went and hid in the chicken coop because her mother and father apparently was not home, where they were not home.
I wanted to make sure I understood his previous statement correctly, so I asked for clarification. Several white men had come to their home to question George Jr. and his older brother, and their younger sister was so afraid that she hid in the chicken coop.
The man didn't come to question them. They came to arrest them. They arrested Mr. Stenny and his older brother, Johnny, who was a few years older than him. And then they went down the road about a quarter of a mile, maybe even half a mile, and threw Johnny out the car and told him, don't let the sun go down on you, nigga. And he was so terrified that he went up to Nichols, South Carolina, caught a bus to New York, and never came back to South Carolina.
It seemed to me that Mr. Stinney had an alibi. It was his little sister. And so I wanted to know more about that.
They never allowed any blacks in the courthouse when there was the hearing. He was the only black in the courthouse. And I don't know how much of verity they would have placed on the testimony of a seven-year-old anyway.
Mr. Frierson stated that George Stinney Jr. was the only black person allowed in the courthouse. But surely his parents were able to be there to support him, right?
No, his parents were not allowed in the courtroom. Yeah, by all accounts, there were 1,500 people in the Clarendon County Courthouse, which is designed to hold less than 300. And there was only one black person in there, and that was a scared 14-year-old little black boy. And then to make it appear legal, they assigned to him Charles Nelson Plowden, a local attorney who was a tax lawyer. And he was actually pitted against, if nothing more, a seasoned solicitor. So I always tell people, if you're starting an endeavor and there is no possibility for you to win, then it's unfair from the beginning. If you can't win, it's unfair from the beginning because the odds are stacked against you.
Mr. George Stinney Jr. was represented by a tax attorney. I needed to know more about the trial, including jury selection.
Well, according to the accounts, there was jury selection at the first part of the day. The trial started, if you want to call it a trial, started at 2:30. It ended at 4:55, which would have been 2 hours and 25 minutes. The jury went out to deliberate at 4:55, came back at 5:05, which would have been 10 minutes, and at 5:30, which would have been 25 minutes later, same day, the presiding judge, read out the sentence to be electrocuted on Friday, June 16, between the hours of 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., with no recommendation for mercy.
This felt like a very short period of time to me. I wondered if Mr. Frierson could outline the time frame for us.
He actually was arrested on Saturday, March 25th, the morning of the finding of the girls' bodies, which they found the girls on the early morning of March 25th, which would have been a Saturday morning. Before noon of that day, they came and arrested him and his brother Johnny. And so this was March the 25th. There was a mock trial, kangaroo court, or whatever you want to call it, on April the 24th, which would have been exactly one month later. And on June 16th, which would have been 53 days after that mock trial or kangaroo court hearing, he was put to death. So all of this happened in the span of 83 days. His arrest, trial and conviction, and his execution, 83 days.
83 days from wrongful conviction to execution. I didn't want to know, but I needed to ask about the execution. Here's a disclaimer. This gets a little graphic.
He was 5'1", 95 pounds, which is undersized for a 14-year-old boy. They had to do something in order to make apparatuses fit. And there is some sayings, and I've never been able to verify this or disclaim it, really, that the sheriff at that time bought him a Bible on the way to the death house, and that was one of the books that he was placed on to actually try to elevate his height in the electric chair. Now, I'm not actually verifying that. I'm just saying what has been said. But I do know that the electric chair was designed for adults. Not a 5'1", 95-pound boy. It was not designed for that. Both parents of the two white girls were there. In fact, it was 50 people. from Clarendon County that came to be witnesses to this debacle, this monstrosity, this atrocity. And during the procedure of the execution, well, of course, because he was undersized, they could not, the electrode that is fit beside your leg to administer the charge through your leg was too long, so they had to extend his legs, his leg that the electrode plate was placed on. And then the metal, well, next would be having his wrist shackled, like a manacle shackle, onto the chair, but it was too small, so they tied it on with leather and straps from what I can ascertain. And after that, they actually put that cap, that metal cap, administered a discharge through your head, of course, and it didn't fit because his head was so small. And then the leather mask that is put over your face to hide your depth of throat, it was too big. And as they sent the first 2,400 volts through his body, the force blew the mask off his face. And so he was exposed to those from Clarendon County who had come to witness. And they looked at him die. They looked at his death throw. They looked at everything. And if you've never seen a person die, then it's not something you want to witness, especially that, not that. The saliva came out of the side of his mouth. The tears came from his eyes. Still somewhat coherent as to what was going on. And then as there was a pause in the process, and then the second charge of 1,400 volts was sent through his body. It drove all the liquids out of his body. Most of your body, as most people know, is made out of liquid, you know. And so that second charge of 1,400 drove all the liquids out of his body. So all you have is bones and posh flesh. And, you know, his sister, in a conversation, said, "Mr. Fryson said they burnt my brother." And I said, "You said they burnt your brother?" She said, "Yes, sir. When they brought him to the church to do the, well, the funeral and the committal, that he looked like a tar baby." And then to compound the second charge, the third charge came with 500 volts. That actually turned him that color. It just burnt. It's just like you overcook something and it just burned black. I don't know if you've ever cooked biscuits, but if you put them in the oven, and once they have turned brown, and if you allow the heat to stay to them after a while, they'll turn black. That's how it was. And when his father requested that Joe's funeral home, our son, go get his body. And when they brought him back to the church, he's buried at Calvary Missionary Baptist Church on Calvary Church Road in Pinewood, South Carolina, where he was actually born in October 21st, 1929. And as they were funeralizing him, some of the elder people in the church say the stench was so bad you couldn't stand it, because if you've never smelled burnt human flesh, it's something that'll make you lose your appetite for days, weeks, or maybe even months. The atrocity that was actually done to this child is something that is just abhorrent. No civilized society would do this. So these were mongrels, and I'm going to call them that. They were mongrels and hate mongers. I should have said hate mongers rather than mongrels. They were hate mongers.
I rarely find myself speechless, but in this case, I was.
The bigger irony is 10 days earlier, before they executed him, there was a battle called D-Day on beaches of Normandy, France. And the Allied forces, this included the American forces, landed on the beach of Normandy. And those Americans' military that were actually there, they were carrying the colors of the United States of America. That's what we the flag with military, we call it the colors. So the colors of America were there. and many people lost their lives on that beach on June the 6th, 1944. Now, 10 days later, this child was actually executed. But if I may backtrack back to April the 24th in that courtroom, there is two things I can guarantee was present in that courtroom, and I wasn't even born. There was a Bible and an American flag. The American flag represents our country. It was despicable that those valiant men who had fallen 10 days earlier under those colors were being misrepresented in a court of supposedly justice. And then there was a Bible in there, because all sworn testimony is given on the Bible, at least at that time. Some people use the Quran now, but not necessarily in a courtroom setting. And so, and it represents to me the word of God. So God was no place in that courtroom. At least his spirit was not. He was gone, was everywhere. The spirit of truth and justice was not in that courtroom. So I just said God was not there, because he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's what he says in his word. So we are just abhorred that someone could have done that. And 2 days later, they probably went to their churches and said, we've done the Lord's work.
Mr. Stinney was able to get legal representation much later in regards to his innocence. And I was able to speak with one of the attorneys who was there on his behalf.
My full name is Miller W. Sheely. I was actually out of the country a couple of years ago teaching law of the sea at a class down there for students in the Cayman Islands and others.
I wanted to know how Mr. Sheely had become involved in this particular case.
I got a phone call just rang one afternoon, and it was a friend of mine at the Post-Union Courier newspaper here in Charleston, the main newspaper. And he asked me about if he could talk to me. I said, sure. And he asked me what I knew about George Stinney Jr. And usually they call me a lot when major cases and litigation is going on, and, you know, especially of a criminal nature, I'm kind of a go-to person. So that's why they were calling. And unfortunately, I usually know, oh, yeah, I know that case. I've seen it on the news. I know the lawyers, something of that nature. But I didn't know anything about it at all. I'm ashamed to say that George. And he said, George Stinney. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, you're going to have to tell me about this. And then he explained a little bit about what it was. And to my surprise, I knew nothing about that. And I said, well, let me do this. I'm out of town. I'll call you when I get home, and let me do a little research. So I went on the computer and, sure enough, read all about George Stinney. And when I got back into South Carolina at the law school, I called him, and he interviewed me. And the whole case was about, you know, George Stinney Jr. at 14 years old. We think he's the youngest person executed in the United States in the 20th century, since 1900. And maybe before, but we're just not sure about the stats of the 19th century. What happened was I gave a brief interview to the newspaper that published it. And the day after they published it, I got called by a former student. His name is Matt Burgess. He was a student in a criminal procedure class. And he called me the next day. He said he read the article, and he said, Professor Sheely, this is our case. We're trying to get justice for George Stinney. That's how I got involved. A student saw a newspaper report, a former student, and was gracious enough to call me and ask for some help, because they were afraid they were going to get dismissed. They'd filed some motions, get the case reopened, and that's how I got involved. And I agreed to help pro bono. There's no pay for anybody here.
I mentioned that when Mr. Sheely normally has a client, they are in fact not deceased, and he's able to meet with them. And so I wondered how he was able to overcome that factor.
It turns out, as you probably already know, there's actually a lot of stuff on Google. And when I got involved in this, there's already a number of newspaper articles, some international, which surprised me, The Guardian, The Telegraph. This stuff really got picked up, and the Sun News. And I said, wow, I was just in shock. I had not heard of the George Stinney story, but up in Sumter, South Carolina, and in Sumter County, this is what I learned is this is legend. This has been going on since 1943. And every now and then, every few years, some event, it's one of these things that some event triggers, you know, like trying to compare it to something, go to like Woodstock or like the shootings at Kent State in the 1960s, you know, but we all know that every year, every now and then something happens and it comes back up on the news. So they show pictures, you know, something brings this memory back. And because of Woodstock, I guess going to Kent State, obviously bad. And that's how it is in Sumter County. Very, very much at the tip of local news, very much at the forefront, and just under the surface all the time. And every 6 or 7 years or so, somehow this thing would. So it's a lot like that. And there's a, if you look up the Wikipedia article, it is largely based on the work of a local historian in Sumter County. His name is in there. He's not a professional historian. He doesn't have academic degrees. He's just. With an African-American gentleman who's just owned this, is kind of local history, just been on it for years, and who's talked to people that has a lot of information. But anyway, I got in the case, and it was my job when I first got in the case. My background is in prosecution. I started off after law school, as you'll see from my resume and other things, as an assistant solicitor. That's basically a DA, district attorney or state's attorney in most states. That's what they call them. It's the basic trial-level prosecutor. That's what I did. And then I was an assistant state attorney general, assistant U.S. attorney. When I first read the pleadings, when my former student senator saw the pleadings, my first thought was, oh, my God, they are going to get dismissed. And I've just got to tell you, from being in the attorney general's office, the state attorney general's office for 8 years, I did this kind of work on the other side, where people challenge their convictions routinely. I mean, not deceased persons or their families, but persons alive. There are literally right. Tens of thousands of people in jail from trial. They're all one way or the other trying to get new trials, and you know, only a slim portion, well over 90, you know, something 5% or less, even get any kind of new trial at all. But this is what I did. I opposed people who filed post-conviction relief actions and habeas actions. I tried to argue that convictions were fair. And that's a substantial portion of my work. And when I first saw the pleading, and gleaned the facts off the internet and gleaned other facts from filings in the case and read the national and international news articles, my first reaction was, you know, oh, my God, this is going to be awful because there's no jurisdiction, there's no claim, that there's just all kind of problems with this case. That's why I got in it, and that's why they got me in it, to try to come up with something to keep it alive, to try to crack the door just a little bit, and encourage the judge to at least wedge her foot in, like Carmen Mullen, and get her to do something. And because I saw it, the door was going to slam shut on the hearing date unless we filed something. And when Matt called me and first asked me to get involved, and I said, when do I have a response? Due and hoping I had a month. He said, next week. So I had to really get to work on this. And that's kind of... I didn't think they had a chance at all. I mean, the obvious problem, and just to be blunt, he's deceased. And, I mean, in criminal court, I mean, you can't convict. I mean, if somebody commits a crime and they die, you don't try dead people. It doesn't work the other way around. I mean, what about clearing their name? They were indicted, and now they don't. Well, too bad. I mean, there's no jurisdiction to do it if the indictments are all dismissed. But, you know, quote, that name can't ever get cleared or removed from the stain, and so the jurisdictional problem was just enormous in this case, and that was the central problem. It stems from the fact that when he's deceased, which is just obvious to any practicing lawyer, that's a problem, because in the civil world, civil claims frequently survive the deceased. Claims of wrongful death and, you know, all sorts of things, that happens a lot. Right. This wasn't, at least on the face of it, in the nature of a civil claim. We had a criminal trial. And not only was he deceased, but he's 70 years plus deceased, remarkably. And this really, I think, weighed heavily in helping us with the judge. Stinney's full siblings, he had two sisters and one brother. All three of them are still alive. I think his brother is in his 80s and in poor health in Brooklyn, where he's lived a good chunk of his life. His sisters, one of them may be in the state, but I think they're both out. The family's long since scattered and gone places. And one sister that testified lives in New Jersey, and we had to locate her. So I learned about George. The simple answer is through three main sources. One, when I could read about him. Two, what his brother, his brother's deposition. I never met his brother, but I met his two sisters. So I know what they told me about him at the hearing. And I met other people in the community, this gentleman who's responsible for the Wikipedia article. I met him, a local African-American gentleman who's kind of the historian, who's kind of taken it upon himself to write the history of George Stinney. And he really knows the details, the down and dirty details.
We know. He's obviously referring to Mr. George Frierson.
That's the third kind of source, is people like him and people in the community who knew stories that were passed down, who would come up to me after the hearing, who were sitting in and say, you know, let me tell you this, and would send letters to Matt Burgess's firm about stuff that we had people contacting the firm before and after the hearing. We can't use it. It's hearsay. And I wouldn't repeat it. It could be defamatory of people who are still alive. But, for instance, we had people contacting us. They may now live in Kansas or Michigan or somewhere. And they say, you know, as a young child, I grew up in Sumter in Clarendon County. And I remember when this happened. I'm 60 years old, and I've got my own. And I remember back in 1943 as a child sitting at the dinner table. And this was a big deal. Or later, even in the 60s, I told you this thing, but one way or another crop back up in the form of a newspaper story or a local media report. And because I was a young man, a child at the dinner table, and I told my father, blah, 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 and my father said, keep your mouth shut about that case, because everybody knew he wasn't guilty. Everybody knew that he took the fall for somebody else. And we have a good idea who that somebody else was. They're deceased now. They've been deceased for a while, for quite a few years. But their family is still alive. And when you read the transcripts and the material in this case, this is what's really powerful. When you read it in this case, you see who the people, who was killed, the two little girls, they were killed by somebody. Right. And when you look at their family names and the people involved, you drive down the main street in Sumter, and it's that family's name on the pharmacy, that family's name on this restaurant, that family's name as an accountant. That's who they all are. I mean, they're descendants, distant cousins, and relatives, but their names are on buildings. I mean, you know, there's no grand conspiracy, I'm not suggesting, but I mean, that's why this is still alive for these people, because those two little girls have relatives of the same last names that are their accountants, their business people, they run a pharmacy, they're still there in Sumter on Main Street. So, and they all showed up. That the cousins, the descendants of the people showed up. And what we were able to piece together, and we couldn't find any real court record. I mean, we found a few pieces, a few documents, genuine old documents, but the quote-unquote court record, what you might think of today as a file, we couldn't find that. Now, I'm not surprised. First of all, just to take you back, so that because people today, I find when I explain to my law students, who are mostly millennials, they've been to college, they know some history, but they don't get this. They don't quite feel it. Because you have to understand that this crime took place in Midland, March of 1944. Okay? Now, first of all, you have to understand what the world was like in South Carolina in March of 1944. And yes, it's Jim Crow and all that, but there's more than that that's really important here. You know, what people did not know in March of 1944, you know, the war in Europe and in the Pacific was raging. I mean, raging. D-Day had not occurred yet. That was 2 months away. Hitler controlled all of Europe. The Japanese still controlled much of the South Pacific. This was before a lot of the big turnaround. And the average person, if you were a man and you were under 45 and you weren't seriously ill, you weren't home. It was all older men, young kids, women. I mean, seriously. That's what the world in America was like, because we were at the height of the war. And while D-Day was planned, the local citizen, from their perspective, we were in a fight for our life. All of Europe was still under the heel of Adolf Hitler, and most of the South Pacific was controlled by the Japanese. So this was the news of the day. That's what was on people's minds. And then plus you have, yeah, Jim Crow, and you have all that going on. But despite all of that, June the 10th, he was dead. That was the execution date. Now, that's lightning fast even for Jim Crow South 19, 40s, mid 1940s. That's why you can't write it off as being real worried about World War II and Jim Crow. I mean, that was lightning fast even for that time. Commit a crime and be dead in about 2 months. And what we found out is that there are newspaper articles everywhere about this. People got petitions, not people just the African American people, prominent white people in the state got petitions. It got so. This is during, like I said, this is up to and leading to D-Day. This makes, you know, the Republican convention and these terrorist attacks, as bad as they are, trivial compared to what was going on in the world. And in bombarding people every day in the paper, literally, about the war. I mean, despite that, there were newspaper articles. It got the attention of the governor, Olin D. Johnston. It got to him, which was just rare in the Jim Crow South for a case. It got so much to his attention that local law enforcement in Sumter, in Clarendon County, was concerned that he might commute the sentence. Wow. Even he was aware of it. Got all the way to the top in the state. And they got so concerned that he was going to commute the sentence that they sent law enforcement agents to go sit down personally with Olin Johnston and talk to him about it. And he finally changed his mind and did not commute the sentence. But, I mean, that just didn't happen in normal involving Caucasians. That just get the governor's attention. Some prominent white folks who could write letters to the editor in the state newspaper, they appeared to think about this. So this case was, for its time, this was kind of a big deal. And despite being drowned out by lots of other news in the general tenor of the state, which is the Jim Crow South, I mean, it got a lot of people's hackles raised, even in the white community. In a prominent white community, they knew something bad had happened.
After all the intense topics that I cover, I wanted to introduce you to my sponsor that helps me with my self-care, The Great Courses Plus. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably like me. You're always searching to learn more. And that's why I'm such a big fan of The Great Courses Plus. It's a video-on-demand service, kind of like Netflix. So it gives you access to thousands of videos on so many topics. You can learn more about the Constitution, civil rights, our legal system, and you can even explore new interests like yoga or psychology or even how to cook. The short video lectures are presented by top professors, and you can watch them anytime, anywhere, from any device, without the student loans. I just watched a great course that could be useful to anyone. It's called Fundamentals of Photography. It was created in partnership with National Geographic and presented by professional photographer Joel Satori. I love to go camping, and I also love to scrapbook. And so I'm sure that my scrapbooks are about to be taken to a whole new level with the skills that I've gained from the Fundamentals of Photography course. I want you to be able to try The Great Courses Plus, and so as one of my podcast listeners, you can sign up and immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of their lectures. So start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. I wanted to know more information about the background on the trial.
Don't have a record of the trial. We know who the judge was. We know who the appointed attorneys were. Interestingly, he had two appointed attorneys, but you have to set the scene in the Clarendon County Courthouse, and we talk about Sumter. Sumter's the next door county where we had the hearing a couple of years ago on this case, because they have a new courthouse that accommodated it. This happened in a smaller next door county in Clarendon County, in the town of Manning, which is the Clarendon County seat. That's where this trial took place. And it's still a small courthouse today. In fact, a lot of it, sans some renovations, may go back to 1943. But the picture you have to set, here was the trial. A month later, this kid was on trial now, at a capital trial. Now, listen, That's lightning fast for Jim Crow. That's lightning fast even for the 1940s.
Wow.
I mean, lightning fast, even then, and especially for a death case. But it was about a month later he was on trial. We estimate that, we believe from newspaper reports and other sources that remember it, that the trial lasted 2 hours, that he had two white attorneys appointed. I'm not casting aspersions on them. They were in a difficult situation. There was no discovery. This is pre-1960s court changes. I mean, there wasn't a lot of law to help poor Stanley out. But there's no transcript, none. And the reason it was none was because they never took an appeal. And that's what we don't know, just why they just didn't take an appeal. I'll come back to that in a minute. And if you can, even to this day in South Carolina, in a lot of states, in federal court, if you don't take an appeal and make a request for the transcript to be produced, it won't be. And that's still true today in federal and state court. I mean, they don't make transcripts. That's expensive. They record it. The stenographers take notes. Those are the two main ways it's done. But those notes are never transcribed, those steno notes, and those recordings are never transcribed unless a prompt request is made for appeal in federal or state court to this day. Now, they'll keep the recording, the stenographic notes for a while, but they're going to get burned after a couple of years or so. Nobody can keep that stuff. What we know from newspaper recording reports and other people is that it was a classic mob scene at the courthouse. The community showed up outside the courthouse. It was packed in and out, but there were no African Americans. Stanley's family was under such a threat that the night after he was arrested, they never saw him again, ever, ever. They went to his grave. They went to his funeral. They had to get out of town. They never saw him again. And they were not at his trial. This 14-year-old child did not have his mother and his father and his family with him at trial. And so they convicted him about 2 hours. It took him back to the jail, and he just waited. Then they sent him to Columbia, to the Central Correctional Institution. And the only other picture of him that we have right before his death, we have a picture of him in 1943, in June, standing outside what they call the Stoney Building, the building where the electric chair was, and another African male standing behind him who was next in line, literally, that day. And Stanley appears to have a Bible in his hand. That's what we think it is. He went in, and that was it. But that's all we had.
And I wanted to know about the trial that exonerated Mr. Stanley.
In January, I think, of 2015, when we started this, when I was in the court in Sumter, and I went to court, and there was no real press, local news then, but I went to court, walked to the Sumter County, the new huge Sumter County courthouse. CNN was outside, NBC was outside, MSNBC, but this was subject to massive coverage. And I thought the parallels, the differences between 2015 and 1944. In 1944, the local press newspaper was there. The crowd outside was all white and local, and the courtroom was packed. In January of 2015, there was another huge crowd, and international and national press were there, and the television was there. And the black community was out in force, both in and outside the courtroom. And as you went into the courtroom, in this case, the difference was, for people to notice, other than the new family courthouse, there was a woman on the bench, which there was no way that was going to happen in 1944. There was a woman on the bench. There were five lawyers in the courtroom representing George Stanley's family, including me. I was one of them that knew what we were doing. And sitting behind us were his sisters and his family and members of the black community. Yeah, and there was a sea of black faces behind five white lawyers sitting there representing him. The reason I put it that way is because on the other side of the courtroom, the local prosecutor for that circuit, for that judicial circuit, just like 70 years ago, the one that prosecuted him, well, not the same person, but the person who held the same office was on the other side of the courtroom. And it's important because that person's name was Chip Finney today. Chip Finney is the first African-American solicitor to hold that position since Reconstruction. And his father, Chip Finney's father, Ernest Finney, whom I got to know very well when I was in the AG's office, was the first African-American appointed to the state Supreme Court, and he became the Chief Justice. And there on the other side, that's the strange thing. Not only were there, you know, it is this female judge, here these five white lawyers with a sea of black faces behind them, including Stinney's family, the remains of it. And on the other side was not a white prosecutor, but an African-American prosecutor with a sea of white faces behind him.
Wow.
The family and friends, it was just completely, it was like a doppelganger, it's completely reversed of what it was in 1944. And it was Chip Finney's job to try to defend that conviction, which he did as nobly and as professionally as he could. But, I mean, that's what, when I sat in the courtroom, I knew that no matter what the result was today, I knew no matter how the judge ruled, whether they followed technical rules of jurisdiction or not, I knew that there could never be another George Stinney, because that wouldn't happen in a courtroom like this. The judge issued her ruling giving him a new trial. Now, what I haven't talked about, and it may not interest you, but just to explain it, how she did it, the pleadings that we filed had to be set aside, and I filed a different motion. I filed a motion called a motion coram nobis, and I knew it because I had seen inmates try to file coram nobis petitions when I was in the Attorney General's office and defended these kinds of things. And a PCR wouldn't help us, a habeas wouldn't help us, but a coram nobis, I did research on the motion going back 400 or 500 years, and it would help us. And to make a long story short, it's a very rare, very ancient, very old common law legal device that still exists, despite some people say that it doesn't, on certain circumstances. And I thought it would work for this one, that we could make it work, and we did. So we found a legal means through an ancient, not ancient, but 400-year-old common law writ that still survives because South Carolina still recognizes the English common law. And that's, we filed a coram nobis writ that allowed us to make different kinds of arguments and get past the jurisdictional issue for the judge to hear some of the case. And she granted our coram nobis motion. That's what happened a year later. And she basically removed his conviction, so his name is cleared. The sentence, the conviction is sentence vacated. And, of course, they can't retry him again. And they wouldn't if they could. So he is actually now not guilty.
I wanted to know, after all of his hard work and research and dedication, how Mr. Frierson had felt about the ruling of George Stinney Jr. as a free man.
I've never felt like that in my life. And I'm a Vietnam veteran who's lost family in Vietnam, who've lost friends in Vietnam. But I've never felt like that, because it only goes to prove that God said in his word in Galatians 6 and 7, be not deceived, because I am not mocked, for whatever man soweth, that too shall he reap. And so he will not allow a lie to stand. Now, in our way of thinking, 70 years is a long time. But in my way of teaching, 70 years is the years it takes for true deliverance. Because the number 7 means perfection or completion in the word of God in Scripture. So I was only looking at God working in an entire way. I was just a vehicle that he chose to do his work. That's all I was. Because what was done in the Stinney case on my behalf was free. In fact, we even went further enough to buy a memorial stone for him.
It's a beautiful stone, which you can find easily by doing a Google search. I told Mr. Frierson that I also appreciated what he had done on George's behalf.
Well, I appreciate it. There's a young lady, I don't think she'd mind me using her name. She graduated from Ridgeview High School in Columbia, South Carolina, this year on May the 30th, and she wrote me a letter. This was a child. And she said, thank you for all the work you've done. Thank you for encouraging us to let us know that we can do all things if we put our mind to it. Thank you for being that shining light. But most of all, I just want to say thank you for George Stinney Jr. I know he would love to say thank you, but he can't. So I will say it for him. Thank you. And that was payment enough for me, that a 17-year-old child took out the time to write me a letter like that. And so it was, as she said, when she read the story about George Stanley Jr. in my work, she said it changed her entire life. Quincy Jones once made a song. What good is a song if it can't inspire, take you higher? Then it's not good enough to sing. And I tell people, if you can't be an example to those come behind you, then your life is in living in vain. So I hope one day that when I'm no longer on the scene, somebody will say, well, you know, we don't know what his motive is because only God can read the heart. But we know that he stuck it out for 10 years. And it was done. And it was done by his insistence that he didn't give up.
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.
God bless you. And anything about justice, and I like what your new organization is, Actual Innocence. I kind of like that. That kind of stuck with me because I don't usually talk to a whole lot of people I've never met, or someone who I know don't know directly, because you have a lot of crazies out there. You know, there was something about you that actually told me to go ahead and consent. God bless you and have a good one.